Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to CMC Radio. I'm your host, Rob May, and joining me again today is Neil Golden. Neil, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Rob. How are you today?
I'm doing great. How about yourself?
I'm feeling good.
Awesome. So, Neil, we know from our past shows now, this is your third show of this most recent series, that you are a stock chart reader. So before we get ahead of ourselves, why don't you reintroduce yourself a little bit as to what it is exactly a stock chart reader does?
Okay, but before I even touch upon that, I'd like to make a disclaimer that trading in stocks is an art. It is not a science. Just because something has happened in the past does not mean that it will happen in the future. And if you are a trader, never trade with money you can't afford to lose. And now I can start talking about stock chart reading.
Sure.
What a person does is basically they look at a chart, and by the movement of the price on the chart over a period of time, they can more or less sort of predict how the prices of a particular stock are likely to move in the future, if the price they think will go up, down, or just sideways. This is one of the major ways. The other way to do it would be what they call fundamental analysis, and that's done by looking at quarterly statements of corporations.
Okay,
so basically I feel that looking at charts is a lot quicker and sure way of doing it if you know what you're looking at and what you're looking for. It's a lot quicker than opening up someone's quarterly report and analyzing their the figures that they're giving you.
Absolutely. And so let me ask you this, because I know we haven't actually covered this particular question, but in terms of a financial planner or someone that you would go to for such advice, is this something that they do? Do they use stock chart reading as a method?
I don't believe they do. They, you know, they're more or less regulated. They, you know, more or less sort of put together all your assets, as far as I know, as far as, you know, your house, your insurance policies, and they total up all your assets and your liabilities, and then they more or less determine your net worth, and then they ask you what your goals are, I believe, and then they try to help you reach those goals that you have in the future. One could be, you know, retirement or to send your kids to college or whatever your goals may be.
Absolutely. And in your experience, now, this must have taken you some time to kind of master, I would assume, right?
It did for me. Some people can do it in a lot shorter time than it took. Mm-hmm. Started off as a hobby, but over a period of time, I just kept coming back and getting better and better. It wasn't an overnight thing, but, it can take a few years.
Absolutely. And for beginners into this, then, what types of resources would they have to look into or utilize in order to really get a hold on this?
Well, one of the things I think most people are probably exposed to is, like financial newspapers. The three that I'm most familiar with and hold in highest regard are like the Wall Street Journal, Investors Business Daily, and the other one would be Barron's, which comes out on a weekly basis. Those are three financial newspapers that usually, in depth, cover the stocks.
Right.
Right.
And then as far as how people can additionally find out a little more about the art of this, really. I mean, because, it sounds to me that this is something that you just can't just jump into. And obviously, with the riskiness of, investing in certain things, you need to really know what you're getting yourself into.
One of the best publishers, I feel, is a place in Pennsylvania called Trade Winds Publications. That's TRADEWINS. They publish a lot of books on the stock, on the mainly technical analysis, which chart reading is a part of. And I'd also recommend this organization if someone were looking for a mentor, because they have a lot of products that a lot of people have developed over the years. And, you know, you just keep looking till you find a person or a mentor that you would feel comfortable with. And
sure.
I think their prices are somewhat reasonable, you know. Yeah.
And did you have a mentor for yourself?
Yes, I did. I had a mentor that was someone else that was pretty well sort of famous in the field, you know, mm-hmm. and they taught the person that I was the that taught me. So, yeah, don't want to mention any names there,
sure.
but yeah, I did. And I recommend a mentor because they can save you hours and lots of time and explain in a very short period of time how things actually work.
So I know, you know, that the obviously touching upon the riskiness factor of investing, I've heard people say that investing in the stock market is just the same as gambling. Would you agree with something like this?
No. Matter of fact, if you know what you're doing and why you're doing, the risks are low and the returns are high.
Mm-hmm.
If you're doing it the correct way. I know in Vegas they were saying things like, you know, slot machines and other forms of gambling are 98% in favor of the house. So, you know, why go there knowing that you would lose money and at the same time claim to have fun while doing it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole thing about investing is, you know, making money. And the more you hate to lose it, the you know, over time, the better you will become at it. It's an art. It's not a science.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so with a lot of the economic, you know, meltdown that we've seen over the recent years, and hopefully now things are picking up, and they seem to be picking up, you know, there's been a lot of talk of the distrust of banks. So in your mind, I mean, what are some ways that people can really be their own security analyst and really take care of themselves here?
I find that to be a very interesting question, and yeah, in talking to banks, like the most recent thing I heard about banks, it was just this week, they said that three of the largest banks, that was J.P. Morgan, mm-hmm. Wells Fargo, and Bank of America, for the first quarter of 2015, they made like $1 billion off of their customers' bounced checks. And what I particularly remember reading about this maybe about 2 years ago, some banks spent like $20 million to write a program to monitor a customer's bank account. And what they do is, instead of cashing checks in the order that the banks receive them when you write them, they now no longer have to do that because they passed laws, which means that they can hold them, but they more or less will hold the small checks that you have, wait for a big check to come through, cash that one, and then bounce your, you know, like your five small checks and charge you like $35 a piece for each small check. And this way, you know, they get money from their customers. You know, it's more or less like estimated that over a person's lifetime, I don't know where they got this figure from, but banks could charge you up to $100,000 in fees and penalties that they really aren't entitled to. So I'm not recommending this, but instead of you know, using a bank account with a large bank, maybe you should look into, you know, opening an account with a credit union or a smaller sized bank that will probably teach you or treat you better and give you more leverage when you need it.
Right.
Right.
But now as far as that goes then, I mean, are there any sort of warnings that people should take when it comes to going to a smaller bank? I mean, what's the disadvantage of a smaller bank?
Well, at the moment, I would say there isn't, other than, you know, ATMs, you know, if you have a debit card that you're using an ATM on your ATM, they may be harder to find. So it may be harder to get cash when you need it. The convenience of a large bank at this point, like they're from coast to coast,
right,
even in foreign countries. But under the old banking rules back in the 70s and the 60s, you know, banks were only allowed to operate in the state that they were incorporated. But those laws have changed, and now, you know, they're from coast to coast. So there's advantages and disadvantages. And people may not be aware of it, but we are coming closer to a cashless society. I don't know when it will take place, you know, and I don't know which one's going to win out in that sense. But that's where the trend that things seem to be headed.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
And so what are some other ways then that people can really be their own security analyst, you know, in terms of just, you know, making sure that their money's safe and that they're doing the right things?
Oh, okay. Well, getting back to brokerage firms, as we mentioned in the previous session, that stockbrokers are given certain stocks to push, you know, to their customers. And actually, they don't really know, you know, whether or not these stocks are everything that they're supposed to be, but they just know that they're supposed to sell, you know, certain stocks. Sometimes, you know, the bank may have an interest in it or, you know, or something like that, but they're more or less told what to do. And there are those people who take advice from their brokers, and there are those people who tell their brokers what to do.
Right.
So in that sense, it's better to know what you're doing and why you're doing it, and instead of just taking advice from a third party who may
sure.
be on your side or may not be on your side, and you don't know, you know. So, you know, one thing I must admit at this point, you know, even though I'm talking about how to be your own security analyst, if you were to ask me, you know, I know in the future, you know, the robots are coming, which will for certain people, and they talk a lot about cloud security, but at this date and time, I could not give you a company to invest in that I know that will be dominant in either one of these fields. So in a sense, it's, you know, up to the person to see how things are going and which ones are out there, and based on their you know, their cash flow of these companies, their growth rate, how long they've been in business, and whether or not these companies are really, you know, a necessity for the individual investor to decide for himself. I just feel that if a person knows the answers to these questions, he will be much better off than if he takes the advice of his broker or a stockbroker.
Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And with that, then, I'm curious, have you ever, you know, seeked or sought the advice of a broker?
No, I haven't. I have had some great luck with you know, mutual funds in the past. In the beginning, when I was just starting, surprising, but no, I do not use a broker now or in the past ever. I just decide by myself, you know, what it is that I want to buy and when to sell it.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, a common question that people would definitely bring up, you know, when thinking about investing, is there a better time of year to invest in certain products?
Well, considering that I'm doing this recording today and it's about, what, May 28th?
Yes.
The only thing I can say is, you know, this may sound funny, but they say in May, sell and walk away. And we're coming upon the summer months, and so this would be like the off season. But in general, the best season is, I feel, from October through April, when most companies are doing, you know, a lot of retail sales and things like that, and manufacturing orders. You know, I'm planning to talk in the future about how the S&P 500 is divided up into 9 or 10 different various segments, but each one of these has its own season, more or less to speak, when these companies are doing, you know, their best. I know, like, right now, there are a lot of electronic shows that are coming out, or, you know, so high tech would be a good season, you know, now to maybe look at for future, you know, earnings growth. But usually during this time of the year, nothing really is going on, and then, you know, in a few weeks it'll be summer, and then, you know, historically, I think the banks during the summer in the past would loan the money to the farmers so that they could grow their crops, you know.
Right.
And, you know, kids would be out of school to, you know, harvest the crops during the summer. But then they would start, you know, going back to school in the fall. And then at that time, I think you know, banks would start lending to manufacturers or industrial producers to help them out and get them so that they can get their products, you know, in time to retailers for Christmas, that kind of thing.
Sure.
So historically, there is a trend there, but it could be changing because, as you know, we're no longer a farming nation, per se.
Right.
There's very few farmers at this time, which sort of brings me to another subject of world hunger, you know.
Sure.
At this point, I think there's about 7.3 billion people in the world, and compared to what the world is, you know, I think the United States is still under 400 million, you know.
Right.
So we don't have that very many people, you know, in this country. But at the same time, we're sort of told that there's a shortage of food in the world. And I think it was back in around 1974 or so, I ran into this pamphlet that was put out by the World Health Organization. What the World Health Organization is, it's like a subsidiary of the United Nations, but they have their headquarters in Geneva, Switzerland, but they're mainly concerned with health problems in the world, you know, like AIDS, Ebola, TB, and malaria, you know.
Right.
Feel that everyone is entitled to the best health that they can afford and attain. So it was way back in the 70s that they were concerned with world hunger and why it existed. And basically, I thought there were food shortages in the world and in the United States, but after talking to a few people that were, say, in the restaurant business, they convinced me it's not the shortage of food. The only reason why people starve is because of political and distribution problems in the world.
Right.
Politics between countries, and then distribution would have to refer to getting, you know, fresh food to people on a timely basis before it rots, you know. So if you can solve these problems, there really wouldn't be any need for people to starve at all in the world at this point. I think the Earth could easily, you know, grow all the food in the United States to feed the whole world. At this point, the greatest problem in the world, I think, is for the future, probably deals with fresh water. That's what everyone is going to be concerned about. You know, China is concerned with it. India is concerned with it. And now the state of California is concerned with it.
Right.
So if we can solve these problems of water and things, then we could go on and maybe solve some of the problems of growing food for the world, mm-hmm. you know, and making sure that people are fed properly.
Right.
Recently, on the news, I guess some of the people have been hearing about a lot of, what do you call it, hurricanes in Oklahoma, and currently it's raining quite heavily in Texas and flooding.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And I think the forecast for meat this summer is that it will be going up, because I know that some of the largest cattle producers are, like, in the Midwest.
Right.
Of the United States. And definitely, you know, they raise cattle in Texas. But my understanding, when it comes to, like, meats and vegetables, for meat, to raise a cow from a calf to up to where it can be slaughtered, it takes about 5 years and a lot of grain to do that, mm-hmm. and a lot of feed and a lot of water. But what I'm hearing at this point is now they're beginning to look at alternative ways for people to get protein, and what they've come up with is growing or harvesting crickets. The sort of, you know, funny thing about this, they're saying pound for pound, 1 pound of meat compared to 1 pound of cricket powder, there's just as much protein. But
wow.
What people have to learn to do is just eat smaller pieces of meat, you know, with each meal, and maybe
sure.
they would, you know, be healthier and live longer. So, you know, that's, you know, more or less the food problem. But on the other hand, you know, in my past, I did work for a short period for a federal government food supply agency.
Okay.
And they used to have these people that were like field buyers, and they'd go out and they'd be buying fresh produce from the mm-hmm. farmers and stuff. And I know the federal government is aware of the fact, but these guys, you know, like they were GS-11s and 12s, but
right.
the thing is, they never retired from their jobs. They would get these jobs, but before they could retire, if they were doing it, you know, close to 30 years, they'd all be dying from cancer. So I know the federal government has the statistics on these.
Sure.
Field buyers and the average, you know, length of their lives. So I'm sure that they are aware of that. And recently, I saw something on TV that was sort of funny. This executive from Monsanto was in France, and he was being interviewed, and he was saying that his pesticide or whatever it was harmless to people. So the interviewer asked him to drink a glass of it, and he refused. And he said, "What? Do you think I'm crazy?" So he refused to drink it on TV and become a hero. So,
of course.
I think now, you know, with what is happening, they've connected pesticides to the fact that, you know, like bumblebees are dying, and bumblebees
right. yep.
need it to, what do you call it, pollinate the flowers and trees to grow fruit and vegetables. So could be a very serious problem. I know in Europe, certain countries, they've banned certain pesticides
mm-hmm.
because they found them to be harmful. So there's a lot of work for, I don't know how old you are, Rob, but your generation and the generation to follow.
Absolutely.
Straighten the problems out, you know.
Well, you know, I think, too, is finding the solutions, you know, there's a lot of different concerns involved. There's a lot of different industries involved, and nobody wants to rock the boat. You know, you can see that that's certainly a problem. You know, really shifting the way that we think and the way that we work together to really make it a difference there.
I find what you're saying to be very, very true. I mean, in a way, you know, business and corporations are all connected to this because they're in it for money, you know, in a sense that
Absolutely.
There's a lot less farmers in the United States these days. But on the other hand, we have big grocery chains, you know. I'm not saying anything bad about Safeway or Albertsons or
sure.
or any of them, but they go out and they buy their produce before it's even grown. They contract with these farmers, and then when the
right.
farmers grow it, they put it in their stores and sell it. So this eliminates the tiny farmer who is trying to just grow things on his own, and, you know, they can no longer sell it on the open
right.
market. So it's all
yeah.
controlled by you know, giant corporations, and in a way, you know, I heard this in the past, I don't know, but if these giant food companies could have their way, you know, they would charge the same price in the United States for an apple as they could get for it in the Mideast, you know, which is thousands of miles away, but because of their pricing, they wish that they could do that.
Right.
So there's some inequality there. I know that, happen to know for a fact that grocery stores, they only operate on a 1% margin basis, which means after selling millions of dollars or whatever,
mm-hmm.
their profit margin is only like 1%, so it would only be like $1,000, and then out of that they have to pay their employees. So
yeah.
it's sort of a tight squeeze, but that's the way they operate. But, you know, between, let's say, Walmart, Safeway, and Costco, right now the most popular conglomerate out there, if you were to ask me, and I'm not recommending that people really buy this stock or anything,
mm-hmm.
but Costco is seems to be decent. And one of the reasons why I think so is because the chief CEO, he only makes like $500,000 a year, and on average
right.
they pay their employees about $13 an hour, which is in some parts of the country, a very livable
Absolutely.
Wage to be
Definitely.
Earning. So,
well, Neil, I do have to say this episode is winding down very quickly. I appreciate you coming on today and sharing with us, again, invaluable information for anyone that's going to get involved in investment. And from everyone here at CMC Radio, we're going to have you back in 2 weeks. So I will talk to you soon then.
Okay, nice talking to you, Rob, and have a good weekend.
All right, Neil, take care, and thank you to everybody for listening. Again, this is Rob May with CMC Radio, and we'll see you soon.
Okay, bye.